This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Tom Latcham on FUBAR Radio.
Sleepy head, put on some clothes, shake up your bed, put another log on the fire for me. I made some breakfast and coffee. Look out my window, what do I see? A crack in the sky and a hand reaching down to me. All the nightmares came today, and it looks as though they're here to stay. What are we coming to? No room for me, no fun for you. I'll think about a world to come where the books were found by the golden ones. Written in pain, written it all by a puzzled man who questioned what we were here for. All the strangers came today, and it looks as though they're here. Don't you know you're driving your
troubles and troubles insane?
Oh, you pretty things. Don't you know you're driving your
troubles and troubles insane?
Let me make it plain. Gotta make way for the whole superior. Look out at your children. See their faces in golden rays. Don't kid yourself, they belong to you. They're the start of the coming race. The other's a bitch, we finished our news. Homo sapiens have outgrown their use. All the strangers came today, and it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, you pretty things.
Tom. Ground control to Major Tom.
Hello.
Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
7, 6.
Commencing countdown, engines on.
Hello, this is the second time in three shows I've opened with this song. But as David Bowie sadly passed away on Sunday after an 18-month battle with cancer, and my name is, of course, Tom, it seemed apt not to. And what a great tune. But it's, of course, just one of many, many brilliant songs he produced, created over the course of the past 5 decades. He released 27 albums and countless singles, many of them absolute smash hits, and we'll be playing out as many as we can today in memory of the great man.
To leave the capsule if you're dead.
Of course, Bowie was not only a musician, he was a producer, actor, painter and style icon. He, of course, pushed boundaries everywhere he went, and his influence will be felt for many, many years to come. And you only need to look at the tributes in his hometown of Brixton, but also around the world, to see how revered David Bowie was. So today we'll pay tribute to a man who helped define popular culture again and again and again. Over 50, amazing, almost 50 years. Feeling not sad at his passing, but happy to have been privileged to have enjoyed his work. And throughout the show, me and my co-hosts, cricket journalist Elizabeth Ammon and football presenter Kiri Blore, will be speaking to some of those who knew him, worked with him and interviewed him. Hello, how are you?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello, Kiri. Hello, Lizzie. How's it all going? Are you well?
You're tired, but all right.
Tired, but all right. That's good. But at least you're here. Yeah. At least you're here. So I'm going to ask you a question, and you don't need to say yes that you are. Are you Bowie fans?
I think everybody is, aren't they? even if you don't know his whole back catalogue, everybody can appreciate the man.
Yeah.
Yes, Lizzie. You know, absolutely. I mean, even though I wasn't a kind of aficionado, there was no way of escaping him sort of in your consciousness.
You mean you didn't shave your eyebrows?
I didn't, or paint my face, or any of those things. And I would be hard-pressed to name you 10 songs. I'd name you 5.
Well, don't worry. We'll be playing a few today. Lizzie, I know it's rude to ask a woman her age, but I am going to.
You're going to ask me how old I am.
Well, ish. You can give a ballpark if you'd rather.
I'm not quite 40.
Not quite 40. So you lived through the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Bowie, huge impact on your life?
No, not really, other than, and this is really embarrassing, he did an intro to the beginning of The Snowman, didn't he? You were looking at me like I'm a lunatic.
Well, but I love what, like, as in the cartoon.
The cartoon, The Snowman.
I didn't know that.
Well, you should YouTube it.
See, now you know everything.
He did a bit of an intro in an attic with a snowman scarf. And that was, yeah.
Well, I love that. I did love that, although I used to cry at the end of it.
At The Snowman.
I mean, that was like not like this Christmas.
Yeah, I was going to say last Christmas.
Yeah, really? Yeah,
a couple of Christmases ago,
you.
I was in tears. I can't watch it anymore.
I was a bit square, you see. I was very much into pop, Bananarama and Rick Astley.
She went there.
My first LP that I bought was Betty Boo.
Really?
Do you like Betty Boo? That was about that sort of time of that sort of pop.
The first
Jive Bunny and the Master Mixers. That was another one.
Single I bought was
Kiri's looking blankly.
Karma Chameleon was the first single.
How old are you?
Not as old as you lot.
Charming. So she won't know who these people are.
She's no idea.
Right.
No,
and we'll have to educate her. But we also want to hear from you. We want your calls, tweets, emails. What are your memories of the great man, David Bowie? And what songs would you like to hear us play today? Get in touch, tom@foobarradio.com, tweet us at foobarradio, or call us on 0330 223 0200. That number again, 0330 223 0200. And we'll play as many of those songs that you request. And I've got some others lined up as well that you get in touch with me, tom@foobarradio.com, on the email or tweet us at foobarradio. Also coming up, it's not all Bowie. You will... I don't know, pleased or, you know, we don't really do too much Bowie because, you know, he did die a couple of days ago. We'd like to pay respects to him, but also we've got other stuff at hand. As we have a cricket journalist with us and a football presenter with us, we'll take a look at the world of sport a little bit later as well. And we're also looking at some of the other stories that have made the papers recently. And there's one story in the Times which, I warn you, could put you off your breakfast. I won't tell you what it is just yet, but we will be discussing it later on in the show. So let's kick off this tribute show in the words of Bowie. I don't know where I'm going from here, but I promise it won't be boring, although I suspect he probably said it slightly better than that. This is Boys Keep Swinging.
In the way when you're a boy.
It's FUBAR Radio here. It's 10:12. This is our Barry tribute show. And of course, you'll be unsurprised to learn that all of the papers are full of Barry. That song there was Boys Keep Swinging, and that was for Alice. Any songs you want us to play, get in touch. Tom at FUBARradio.com, tweet us at FUBAR Radio, or call us with your memories. 0330 230 0200. I'm here with Kiri Blore and Elizabeth Arman. Oh, what should I say? Lizzie or Elizabeth? What would you rather?
Lizzie's fine.
Lizzie's
less
fine.
Less of a mouthful.
It is less of a mouthful. Yes. That's always useful on this show. You guys have been looking at the papers. Wall to wall, Barry?
Wall to wall.
Pretty much.
How have the papers covered it? I mean, they were in a slightly tricky position, weren't they, the papers? Because he passed away Sunday night, but it really broke at Monday morning at 8 o'clock. Certainly 6, 7, 8 o'clock in the morning. Too late for any of the papers to have got it. So, in a way, it was tricky because it was too late, but then they have had a whole day, I suppose, to gather their stuff, because it was a big secret that he was in.
Absolutely, and I have to say, there is some beautiful writing. I mean,
really?
Even if you are not a Bowie aficionado or, you know, deeply moved by his death, you must appreciate that the obituaries are beautifully written and really emotional, even if you aren't feeling the emotion yourself, which I have to say I'm not, and there's no point pretending I am.
No, fine.
Alexis Petridis in The Guardian, I read this last night, it's a really, really beautiful piece of writing. There's something in The New Statesman, I can't remember who by, it is lovely. The Telegraph have done it really, really tastefully. I think what is really striking is that there aren't many people who get themselves on every single front page, red tops, broadsheets, you know,
everything.
You don't. There aren't many people who die who get themselves on the front page of every paper.
No. I mean, what a lot of the papers are pointing out was interesting, how he managed to keep it secret for 18 months. A man who is, as you just said, Lizzie, gets on all the front pages. He's very well known. He is known. He is of interest to the world, to newspapers. And yet he managed for 18 months, while he battled pancreatic cancer, he managed to keep it a secret. I mean, that's stunning, isn't it, Kiri?
It is stunning, because also, if the papers knew, they would have had their sort of obituaries all written up, wouldn't they? They normally have them prepared when they're sort of ready for this thing. So he very definitely did keep it a secret. But I suppose that shows how much he meant to the people around him, because generally a secret is, as Charlie Sheen knows, it's too difficult to keep a secret. So,
I mean, was there even any hint that he was ill? Because I know he turned up for the Lazarus premiere looking very gaunt, and he did collapse one of the papers he's brought in today.
But I mean, the gaunt thing was sort of his style, so I suppose no one would have really questioned it.
And he has, I mean, he has been ill before, he's had heart attacks. So it's not like if he collapsed, anyone would go, he's about to die. It just, but I think what is so impressive about sort of his death is representing the way he lived his life, was that he clearly did not want people to remember him as an ill man, and so kept himself away.
And as the Times says in one of the quotes, that it says, it was a carefully managed stage exit, which was another extraordinary achievement from a man who has changed like a chameleon again and again and again throughout his career, and always, you know, everything he's done has been, as it says, stage managed.
Yeah, it's fascinating that he managed to create the video, do everything on his parting gift for the world. It's quite special, I suppose, for his fans, isn't it, that he managed to create that whole scenario.
And there are, it says, The Mail and other papers, as I'm saying, there are hints in the lyrics to a song from Black Star. Look up here, I'm in heaven, for instance, and there are others. And they say that he turned his death into a work of art. Imagine being able to turn your death into a work of art.
I mean, we all kind of want that, don't we? We want to leave a legacy, and we want to be able to decide how we go. And
I'm probably going to just keel over and go.
There aren't going to be very many of us who leave a legacy like Barry.
No, this is very true. And I mean, Lizzie, you have lived through.
Yes, thanks very much for keep pointing this out.
I'm not going to keep pointing it out, but it is true. You have lived through it. You might not have. He might not have rubbed off on you necessarily, but when you were at school, did he noticeably rub off on your peers and your classmates?
Yes, and certainly when I went to university, there was always, and in fact all the way through my life, I knew of great groups of Bowie, I mean, they weren't just fans, they were obsessives. And it sort of dictated their whole life, you know, and even to the point where you're an adult and people have still got posters on their bedroom wall and you think, well, clearly this man's a bit...
Which adults do you know, Lizzie, that have got Bowie posters on, or any posters comes out on their wall? I think you're hanging out the wrong sort of people,
well,
frankly.
In fact, they moved from posters to framed.
Yeah, that's the thing, framed side artwork, doesn't it?
It gets a little bit classier as you get older. But clearly, the power of the man and the power of his work transcended genres, really, because you know, when you hang out with the dancey types or the indie types, or the, you know, there was a common theme, and it seemed to be this man and his work.
I mean, he did also have his troubles in the past. I think I've read someone said that he was during the 90s, late 80s, early 90s. He was existing on red peppers and cocaine, a diet of red peppers and cocaine, and making people describe him as the actor. Which I think it's a lot like my life,
that's
really, except I just survive on chips and make people call me the dirty hack. That's pretty much we're very similar.
Red peppers and cocaine, it's an interesting one.
Yeah.
I don't know
the red peppers.
Red peppers are very nutritious.
Are they the easy bedfellows, cocaine and red peppers? I don't know. Do they sort of complement each other? there was actually a video that I saw yesterday when which he was interviewed. It was when he moved to Berlin. That was when he really got addicted to cocaine.
Well, Berlin, wasn't it, in the Times?
Yeah, and he got really badly addicted to cocaine, and he gave an interview on British television, and it was just when General Franco had died, and they wanted to use the line to sort of for a Spanish channel to sort of cover that, and he refused and said, no, I'm doing this interview, gave this interview, rambling mess. But he, you know, he managed eventually to pull himself back. He partly to do with his most recent marriage. And we'll be talking to Alan Palmer, who's a journalist who interviewed in 2003, one of his last interviews since then. I mean, they were all of these outpourings. You can't be a top leading artist, pop star, actor, whatever, without breaking some eggs. Everyone is saying what a great guy he was. Do you reckon there must be something, some element of him that wasn't wondrous?
I'm not sure. You know, there's even, I don't know what I just read it in, where it said he punched me in the face, but he still sends me a Christmas hamper every year, but he met him when they were in Cubs when they were nine. So I'm not actually sure there is. Everybody seems to love him.
I love the fact that someone who punched him has been featured in the paper as paying tribute to him. The other person, of course, who is close to him once upon a time was his first wife, Angie. She's
not so close anymore, one might say.
No, she's in the paper today. Well, she's not just in the paper. She's in Celebrity Big Brother, isn't she?
She's on the telly box, yeah.
And what has she been told?
Oh, she's been told. She's been told live on air. It was mawkish and...
Watch it? No.
I've seen the clip. I wish I hadn't. It's mawkish and horrible, really.
Really?
Yeah, it's not
great. I think
they
should have told... Well, but we don't know. Maybe they did tell her off air and then said, do you want to do it on air? We don't know, I suppose.
And how did she react, Lizzie? I haven't seen the clip, I've got to say.
Slightly melodramatic. I mean, well, I feel for her because whatever... she feels about him now, he was a part of her life, and you always feel a bit sad about bits of your life that so she's, you know, she was quite hysterical and it was just horrible, mawkish television, and I think it's hideous.
I mean, she is only, of course, on there because
of who she
because she was married
exactly,
to him.
Exactly. I just, yeah, it's not, it's horrible car crash television, really.
They got lots of...
It is Celebrity Big Brother.
I know, I mean...
Well, she did say, she did an interview with Jan Moir in...
Moir.
She'd like it to be Moir.
Jan
Moir. She did an interview with Jan
Moir.
Horrible
hatchet job, yeah.
Where she did an interview with her before, and that came out yesterday morning.
Perfect timing.
Which really was quite... And she was basically really slagging him off. It did age particularly badly. I mean, they didn't get on. I mean, Kira, you were wondering whether she'd get an invite earlier to the funeral.
Unlikely. Well, because you don't get invited to funerals, do you? They're sort of, so that's what I'm saying. She's obviously going.
I would imagine this one will be a public affair. Not an open invite.
Come on, come all. I think they might have to bring in police if they were to do that. Yeah, I mean, Angie Bowie, they really had a... a very difficult relationship, and also their son Zowie. I love that.
I know.
It's not. It's a real name's Duncan, but Zowie Bowie doesn't talk to his mother anymore either. So read into that what you will, I suppose. We've been asking you guys what your thoughts were. Sophie New Zealand said, "Oh, I'm so sad. He was the first man I fancied, partly because he was so beautiful, and partly because he was so different. He made me realise you could be weird and fantastic." And Simon in Ipswich, who's a regular listener, says, "He was an inspiration. He wasn't afraid to experiment outside the norm." Get in touch with more of those. Tom at FoodBarRadio.com. Tweet us at FoodBarRadio. Call us on 0330-223-0200. Also, which songs you want us to play, get in touch. Tom at FoodBarRadio.com. Tweet us at FoodBarRadio. And I'm going to play a song now, which my mum requested, which doesn't sound that weird until you learn that my mum's actually deaf. And she's been deaf since 1960-something. And she's asked for a song from 1985. So I don't quite know how that works, frankly. But she won't be listening to this, so I can't ask her either. Why?
Music video.
I think it was the video, because the video, because the song is "Dancing in the Street" by Bowie and Mick Jagger. That song was recorded by them for. It's quite an interesting story actually behind it. It was recorded them for Live Aid in 1985. The original plan was to perform the track together with Bowie at Wembley and Jagger at the John F. K. Stadium, but then it was realised that the satellite link would cause a half second delay and someone was going to have to mime, and neither of them wanted to do that, so they recorded a video instead. I think my mum just likes the sexy dancing. That's
fine.
That's fine. So I'm sorry, mum, you can't hear this, but you can watch she posted the video on Facebook. So this is "Dancing in the Street" by Bauer and Jagger. We'll be back for some more stories on FUBAR Radio with Kiri Blore and Lizzie Armin on FUBAR Radio after this. It's 10:24.
but her mummy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go, but her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad thing for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools if they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Oh man, look at those gay men go. It's the freakiest show. Take a look at the is their life on Mars. It's on America's tortured brow. Mickey Mouse has grown up a cow. Now the workers have struck for fame, 'cause Lennon's on sale again. See the mice in their million hordes, from Ibiza to the Norfolk Broads. Rule Britannia is out of bounds to my mother, my dog and clown. But the film is a sad thing for, 'cause I wrote it 10 times or more. It's about to be written again, as I ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Oh man, look at those cavemen go. It's a take a look at the old man, beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if he'll ever know who's in the best-selling show. Is there life on
I apologise for that. Gremlins in the System. We haven't been back since Christmas, so we'll try and make sure that doesn't happen again, but I can't actually make any promises. Anyway, I'm here with Lizzie Armin and Kiri Bohr, my co-presenters. It's 10:31, it's FUBAR Radio. That was Life on Mars, because we had to play that, because my mum's song... It's a good job she's deaf. she couldn't hear that go horribly wrong, and so we had to play Life on Mars instead. And Life on Mars for Martin, Keith and Stuart. Get in touch with any more requests, tom@fubarradio.com, or tweet us at FUBAR Radio. You guys have also been going through the papers. There's other stories. It's not the only story in town. Now, I hinted earlier about something that could put our listeners off their breakfast. It refers, of course, to my beloved former boss, the man who... later sacked me, not sacked me, sacked us all at the News of the World. He's, of course, Rupert Murdoch. Kiri, what's he done now?
Well, he's marrying Jerry Hall, which is bizarre, because they've only been dating for a matter of months, haven't they?
But 4 months.
Where this all came from, I don't know. Someone should have a word with her.
Have they learned, what I want to know is, have they learned nothing from the Cheryl Cole revelations over the weekend? You know, they knew each other, her and Jean Bernard. They'd only known each other for 3 months, got married, no prenup, and now she's going to lose £8 million. There was several life lessons, I thought, in the papers over the weekend. One of which, don't get married after 3 months, a bad idea. And the other was in relation to the chap who's been alleged to have killed his wife and 3 children. Don't go back to your hometown when there's an international manhunt. It's pretty obvious. But Rupert Murdoch hasn't taken this life lesson. Lizzie, is it a bad idea to get married after 3 months?
I think my own view is that marriage is a bad idea, full stop.
Oh, you're cynic.
No, I know, but it's 2016. Why do you need to? Just don't bother.
This is true.
Especially when you're that age. Well, by all means,
but isn't that the point? If you're that age, what's to lose?
Yes, but I agree with you totally.
Just to have a relationship. Is she going to have a big white frock and walk down an aisle with some flower girls? I mean,
I do love the fact. So,
what's she going to do?
So this is his. Is it his third or fourth marriage? I think he's been married 3 times before. This is going to be his fourth.
See, that's when I don't get it.
Yeah, no.
Why?
So you're going every single time. You're like, till death do us part. Yeah, I will love you forever and honour you forever, unless it happens to be like the last time.
Till the next time.
Kiri, are you disappointed in Jerry Hall? You like Jerry Hall, don't you?
I love Jerry Hall. I don't get it. I have my own theories.
We probably shouldn't say your theories on air, really.
I just don't get it. She's taller than him. She's prettier than him. She's younger than him. She's better than him.
Why would the...
I feel like her mother right now. I need to go into...
Why would the supermodel Jerry Hall marry aging multimillionaire Rupert Murdoch?
I nearly went there. It's not what... I suppose.
I mean, it is.
You can't really have lots of sex, so you may as well get married because there's nothing else to do.
Can't you?
Well,
can't an 84-year-old man have sex? I mean, I don't know. I mean,
I don't know either. But I'm
Lizzie's like recoiling.
It's too early in the morning for this sort of chat. It's before lunchtime. Can we just not talk about Rupert Murdoch and carnal knowledge of women?
He reminds me of a turtle.
Oh,
does he remember an old turtle? You know, just sort of on his back.
With his legs flailing.
Wow, we've just gone way too much for visual detail there.
It's just mental images we don't need. We just don't need it. I mean, you know, good luck to her, whatever, but why?
Well, at least she's not 20. It could have been worse.
Yeah. Well, so how old was Wendy Deng when they were quite young, weren't they? Well, she was quite young, rather. She was, but I mean, Wendy Deng was an interesting one as well. She, I don't know if you know anything about Wendy Deng's background. Do you know anything about Wendy Deng's background? So Wendy Deng was brought over from China by a family. She was a very bright child in China.
She's beautiful as well.
Very beautiful, very bright. Brought over from China by her by a family who put her up and helped her to go to one of the top universities in America. I can't remember which one. And she then ended up going off with a husband. So that gives you an idea of what Wendy Deng's
nice.
Like. And then she obviously ended up with Rupert Murdoch. And we, as the rumours suggest, whether it's true or not, we don't know, but she was alleged to have had relations or certainly become very, very close to Tony Blair, who is also godfather to their child.
See, but that's...
Lovely.
So she's got bad taste in men. Got that. Jerry Hall has got amazing taste in men. Just not sure what happened.
It's true. Going from Mick Jagger to Rupert Murdoch is like going from a Porsche to a...
Well, one of my friends got married recently.
To a Skoda or something.
Yeah, she had a kid. And she said, maybe I was just drunk before. I didn't know that he was such an arse. So maybe, I don't know, speculate to accumulate.
She's only known him for 4 months. Maybe she hasn't got to know the real... You know, because no one knows anything about Rupert Murdoch, do they? He keeps himself so quiet. There's a, as I was saying, Barry isn't the only front page story about today. Lizzie, you're a mother.
I am.
Are you a tiger mother?
No.
No. What is a tiger mother, and why am I talking about tiger mothers?
Because our beloved Prime Minister, remember, a man who leaves his daughter in the pub. On the back of the whole everyone should have parenting classes, has said that all children should have tiger mums. A tiger mum being one who is a sort of fairly strict disciplinarian and, as the name implies, a bit of a tiger. Now, that I don't know where he gets off telling us how we do our parenting. It's especially odd for a Conservative to be telling, because Tories are not supposed to interfere in your private life. That's the whole notion of being a Conservative.
That's true.
Is that you're supposed to be a bit libertarian, and actually you believe that the state shouldn't interfere in all these things, and you should have freedoms and capitalism and all of those things.
Although didn't they do Back to Basics? What was Back to Basics?
That went really well.
Well, it was particularly bad.
Nobody knew what it meant. It's the same as the whole, what was the community programme they were talking about that nobody ever knew what it was about? Nobody knew what it was, and it didn't. Nobody took up the parenting classes last time they offered them. I suspect they probably won't this time either. Because it's not that difficult. I'm not.
Oh, hide your light under a bushel,
it's
Lizzie.
Honestly, I'm not. I'm by no means Mother of the Year in any way, shape, or form. I'm a single mum, and according to the Conservatives, I'm the, you know, evil parts of society, women like me breaking down society, single mums and everything. But it's not that difficult to be a parent.
I mean, if you find it not difficult to be a single mum, I think that's hugely impressive, because
difficult.
Me and Sophie are considering at some point in the next year.
You mean you're being grown up?
Yeah, we'll be considering maybe trying for family and that sort of thing. And the idea, while being nice, also does vaguely sort of terrify me. I mean, I know you've just got to not kill it, right? But like,
no, it scares the heck out of me.
Mostly just don't kill it, yeah. I mean, everything else just...
Like a Tamagotchi.
Honestly, seriously, stupider people than us have brought up kids perfectly fine.
That's my only argument to how I might be able to cope with it, is that there's got to be...
It's like driving. Really, really, really stupid people manage to pass their driving tests. So everybody can pass their driving test, and pretty much everyone can manage to be a parent. Now, I'm not belittling the fact that some people find it really difficult because of their circumstances, and because there are lots of challenges, particularly if you have children who have, you know, particular issues. But tiger mums, and also the psychologists, and I tend to listen to experts rather than the Prime Minister on these things, is that overly strict parenting can cause depression and self-esteem issues and this and the other. And that's not how it is these days, is it? It's just not
It's not, but has it been taken mildly out of context? Is that the only thing? From what I'm just reading here, is maybe he was just trying to...
He needs to not talk about parenting. He left his kid in a pub. He needs to shut up.
That is remarkable.
Stop talking about parenting.
Have you ever left your kid anywhere, Lizzie?
At the swimming pool, yeah.
Did you?
I left him anywhere. I just forgot to pick him up.
It's all right. My mum used to do that to me all the time. Standard.
So, you know, we've already said that my mum was deaf. So obviously you wander off in supermarkets, don't you? Have you ever had that where you've had to put a call out over the tannoy or whatever public address?
It is the worst feeling in the world.
Have you had to do that?
Yeah.
Obviously my mum couldn't hear those things.
Oh no!
So that, and I knew that as a child,
so
and that made me even more upset. And I would just be like in floods of tears, like I'm never going to see my mum ever again because she's deaf and she can't hear the public address system.
Oh bless you! Me and my brother found it amusing. We'd run away for hours.
Well, I was on my own.
Oh, Habitat. We used to hide out for hours and hours and hours.
There was a story a while ago about a kid that went and lived in IKEA. Do you remember that?
That's worse for a week. There's a lot worse.
For a week.
A lot worse places.
I think that's a really good idea.
Meatballs and beds and
sofas. If you've got nowhere to... I'm not strongly encouraging this, just mildly encouraging it. You've got nowhere to live.
Mum.
Just saying.
Mum, there's a bloke in the shower. What's he doing?
Is that from life experience? Or is that...
I don't know what he's doing. There's not even any water.
I just think it's a bit galling that... being lectured to...
I like the way you brought this back.
It's a bit galling being lectured about parenting from a man who went to Eton and has a trust fund.
Yeah.
You know, you don't understand, mate, how living in a one-bedroom flat with three kids and not having any money is quite challenging and might make you lose your rag a bit. Because you have nannies and, you know, let's just rein it in a bit before you start lecturing us all on how we do our parenting.
I can't remember what someone said to me once. Would you allow a group of people who've been through the care system, to run the country?
Yes.
It's not about where you came from, though.
No, but it's happening, isn't it?
Yeah.
Half the cabinet have been in care. They all went to boarding school.
I went to boarding school.
We like to represent a whole range of opinions here. Oh, sorry, Lizzie. Oh, we've got a couple of posh ones in today.
It's not... Oh, my gosh.
But the point is, I wouldn't... understanding that you come from privilege is a really important part of empathy towards people who haven't had those privilege.
Do you feel that the Conservative Party show that?
No. They have no concept of their own privilege.
This is what I find funny.
But it's the same as the Labour Party. Let's not be ridiculous. No political party, no MP has come from... Okay, there may be one or two. The majority,
some of them through trade unions.
One or two. The majority are from affluent families that will have been through an education system.
You need money to get into politics. It's very, very tough.
But also, you've come through an education system. It does drive me a little bit mad that people say every politician out there pretty much has come through some relative higher education. Mm. It's not one particular party. It's politics.
I find it hard to be not partisan, being a staunch socialist.
me also. But I mean,
card carrying.
But there is anybody who has had a relatively, it doesn't matter what party they are, yes, I'm a socialist, but I'm not necessarily Labour or Tory. But any party who says, oh, haven't I done, you could do well like I did. I dragged myself up
that's
by the bootstraps.
That's the bit that drives me mad.
And David Cameron the other day saying, I really fear for the future of my daughter, whether she'll be able to get on the housing ladder or not. You've got 30 million quid, mate.
Well, and also,
She'll be okay.
You're the Prime Minister. Do something about
it. That's more the point, isn't it?
You've got the power to do something about this.
Absolutely right. Well, there's plenty more to be said on this, and I'm sure we'll come back to it in the future. We're going to have another song that probably Lizzie's never heard of, but...
I'm not coming out of this well
this
at all.
This is an education. It's an education for you, Lizzie. We may or may not. We probably won't put on some Bananarama later. This is The Man Who Sold the World by David Bowie, and this is for Anna. Get in touch with your request. Tom at foodbarradio.com or tweet us at foodbarradio. We're going to be talking a bit about Bowie, but also more about the stories that are in the paper. It's 10:44 here on Foodbar Radio.
And when, although I wasn't there, he said I was his friend, which came as some surprise. I spoke into his eyes. I thought you died a long, long time ago. I roamed, I gazed a gazeless stare at all the millions here. We must have died alone a long, long time ago.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so fucking crazy you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they tortured and scared you for 20 odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Keep you doped with religion and sex and TV. And you think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile as you kill. You want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.
Yes, that song there, Working Class Hero, was for regular listener. Steve Emerson, hope you're listening, mate. That's for you, pal. It's not an exaggeration, as we say, we're talking about Bowie a lot. That was him, of course, there. It's not an exaggeration to say that Dana Gillespie grew up with David Bowie. Having met him as a teenager, they briefly dated, and then they had an incredible working relationship. She performed backing vocals on the track It Ain't Easy from his Ziggy Stardust album. And then she later recorded an album which was produced by Bowie and Mick Ronson in 1973, called Weren't Born a Man, and she joins us on the line now. Hello, Dana, how are you?
Hi, I'm well, thanks, and thank you for pronouncing my name correctly. However, I'm amazed the amount of people that don't pronounce Bowie's name right. It's Bowie, not Bowie.
Is it Bowie?
It's Bowie, yeah, like a Bowie knife. Ah. It's Bowie, and I hear all these pillocks on the BBC saying his name wrong. Well, so I try and correct people, but I can't understand how anyone can think it's Bowie.
Well, I thought that it was Bowie.
Bowie, as in bow tie.
Right.
Exactly, Bowie. But there's such a thing as a Bowie knife, and that's how it came to be Bowie.
Well, I'm glad I pronounced your name right, Dan.
Yeah. Dan arrives with a spanner.
I know that, but, and I know that because I rang you up yesterday to see if you could come on, and you told me off. So.
I know. Sorry about that.
That's fine. How are you, anyway?
I'm good. I'm really well, actually.
I mean, what have you felt about the coverage today and yesterday?
I think it's fabulous. I mean, I've had loads of people emailing me saying sorry about your loss and how terrible, and I don't feel that way at all. I mean, I think it was Madonna said something like she was devastated. I think that's a load of twaddle. You know, Bowie was... there's no point in being devastated about anyone dying. You know, he did exactly what he wanted to do in his life. He created up to the very end. What more can a creative person want than to have an album out 3 days before their departure? And, you know, he knew he was dying. I think it's very cool that he kept it quiet and suddenly, so he didn't have to listen to all that madness of everyone kind of wanting to know info. He was cool to the end and stepped off the planet perfectly, in my opinion. And I think there's no need for devastation. He's left behind such a great legacy of work, a body of work that, you know, such originality and songs and, you know, the clothes exhibition is trailing around the world. And I live opposite the South Kensington, opposite the Victoria and Albert Museum. And when it was a year and a half ago, when the exhibition was on, there were queues and queues down the road to get in to see it like there's never been before for anything else, you know. And he was loved, but I don't think that's a reason to be devastated. It's a reason to go, yeah, this guy really did it all. You know, he acted, he wrote, he produced, he lived life in the fast lane, then he slowed down, but that happens to everybody. And he had a great life, and he should be sort of... I think about him with joy. I can't feel sad at all.
I mean, you first met him in 1962, before he got famous. Could you tell he was going to be a huge success?
No, definitely not, because don't forget, which I think it might have been 1963, I can't remember whether it was 63 or 64, perhaps I was 14, so it could have been 63. I'm very bad with dates, but you know, you've got to remember that that era was something that even to think about America was almost unthinkable. I mean, it was a mega thing to even fly to America, and we didn't have the kind of connection that we have with over there. So maybe he thought about making it in England, but nobody thought of cracking it in America, and certainly not maybe being as big as Elvis Presley or on a par, because it just was out of the remit of the average English person. But then in 1970, and David had always said, I've got to have I really need a good manager. And he said, and when I find the manager, I will make sure that you get managed by him too. He was always very nice and kind to me musically. I think music was our main connection. Anyway, so he found Tony DeFreeze, who had this company called Main Man, which really, he was very instrumental in making sure that Bowie and all the Main Man madness and roster and everything, which included myself, all moved to America, because Tony DeFreeze said that really only by being in America can you really become stellar and eclipse whatever happens in England. You can have a number one hit in England, but it doesn't mean diddly until you've cracked America. So he had the money and the wherewithal to actually push David out and about in America and made him over there, and then put David in front of extraordinary different influences, whether it was the Andy Warhol things or the gay world, or, you know, just to be in another country was particularly good for him.
And you worked together on Ziggy Stardust in 1972. What was he like to work with? Was he inspirational as a musician?
Well, again, you see, I've known him for so long, I never kind of thought of him like that. When I first met him when I was 14 or something, and I'd already started to write songs, he used to, you know, we used to play each other's songs. I know it sounds corny, in between, you know, just hanging out. When you said dated earlier on, I think that's a disgusting American terminology that I never use. Okay, we shared the bed occasionally, but I was 14 and 15 and he was 17 and 18. Much more interesting was the interest in music, and I used to go with him to the studios at Ready Steady Go, which then put me on as an artist, and he taught me the second song I actually sang on live television, which was then. And So he, inspiration is not the right word. He always just was there and guided me, you know, if I ever needed to, haven't need any guidance. And then one time he rang me up and he said, oh, I've just written a song half an hour ago. Can I nip over and just play it to you? Because he lived around the corner, and he came around and played Space Oddity. And even then, one never thought, oh, this is going to be a mega hit, because he was groundbreaking. People hadn't done that kind of thing before, so nobody could foresee what he could become. Then by the time we'd found, or he'd found Tony DeFries and we were signed to Main Man, that's when the all the stuff, being at the John Peel show and doing the recordings of Ziggy Stardust. I mean, I think I'm only on one track, actually, which is It Ain't Easy, which David didn't even write. But I can't say inspirational is not my thing. His music was very different to mine. What was good was he did say he was going to produce my third LP, which was my first for RCA, which he started off to do, and then suddenly he got so huge in America that Mick Ronson had to finish it off, but not before he'd written this song for me called Andy Warhol.
Yes, and we're going to play that later. And when did you, he fell out with his management company, moved away. Did you stay in contact? When did you last speak to him?
Not really, no, because, you know, I don't go to America much. I'm very much, you know, I'm in places like India, and I'm in countries like Uzbekistan. I'm in countries that people don't normally want to go to, and America's never... I lived there for 2 years. We all moved to America, and I stayed for months with David and Angie in the Sherry Netherlands Hotel, and I was there, but as the company Main Man started to kind of crumble... And we were such a close family that it was more, it wasn't so much a fallout, but of course triggered by finances, and which I was kind of stuck in the middle because it had nothing to do with me. It was David's money that had been kind of used and blown. I wasn't making that kind of money, but I was part of the deal. And so when I kind of came back to England, which was 70, I can't remember whether it was 75 or 76, that's actually the last time I saw him. I spoke to him since then, but I don't really go to America more than once every 3 years, and even then only stay for a couple of days to do whatever has to be done, and then I get out.
And so before we let you go, what's your lasting memory of David?
Well, I've got too many freeze frames, if you know what I mean, in the past. We just used to have such fun, you know, in the days of the kind of... the very late 60s or early 70s. I mean, I've got loads of memories that are a bit X-rated, so I won't tell you on the radio.
This is FUBAR Radio, so, you know, we're not Ofcom regulated. You can pretty much say whatever
Dana. I don't kind of do that. I don't kiss and tell. But my memories are basically always him sitting, lolling around with scraps of paper in front of him, writing songs. You know, music was always the most important thing to him and to me, and I think that's why we always stayed friends through it all. You know, I really got to know him so well. And I've got to say, one memory I've got to say is probably the Diamond Dogs tour, which never came to England, but, you know, Main Man was still functioning, so we were all in America. And I've seen many great live shows in my life, but this has to be one of the best ever, you know, from the choreography and the top lighting guy, Jules Fisher, who's a kind of huge star on Broadway. I mean, Bowie at that time had it all, and it's such a shame the show never actually came to England. But so I've got a memory of that, and him going out over the audience in a little space capsule which he would sit in while singing Space Oddity, and I'd sit in the front, and whenever he would sing Tell My Wife I Love Her Very Much, which is one of the lines of the song, Angie would kind of glow. God knows how she's dealing with Big Brother, but how anyone deals with Big Brother is a mystery to me.
Well, that's absolutely right. Dana, listen, thank you for your thoughts. It's been lovely to speak to you today.
Okay.
All the best, Dana.
All right, so you're going to play Andy Warhol?
I certainly am.
What, his version or mine?
I'm going to play his version, but it is... so tell us a little bit about Andy Warhol. And who wrote it first? You?
He wrote it for me.
Right.
And I recorded it first, and you can hear him on my version. You can hear his voice in the background, and you can hear him playing the 12-string guitar, because he was very fond of 12-string guitar. And then he liked the version that I'd done with Mick Ronson and him so much that he decided to do his own version on his, what was it, Hunky Dory album, I think? Can't remember.
I think so. Let's play it. And thank you, Dana, so much for joining us. Dana Gillespie there. Thank you. Thank you. All the best. Bye.
All right. Bye.
That was Dana Gillespie. And this is Andy Warhol.
Like to take a cement fix, be a standing cinema. Dress my friends up just for show, see them as they really are. But the people in my brain, too new pants to have a go. I'd like to be a gallery, put you all inside my show. Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all. Andy walking, Andy tired, Andy take a little snooze. Tie him up when he fast asleep, send him on a pleasant cruise. When you wake up on the sea, be sure to think of me and you. To think about paint and to think about glue, what a jolly boring thing to do. Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all. Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
Yes, it's 11:06 here in this Bowie tribute. Thanks to Dana Gillespie there, say her name correctly. multiple Grammy Award-winning producer and friend of the show, Steve Lillywhite, has produced some of the biggest and most influential albums of the modern rock era, including U2, Peter Gabriel, Simple Minds, and many, many others. And he credits Bowie's music as being among his biggest influences, saying the 1971 album Hunky Dory changed his life. And he, thankfully, I'm pleased to say, joins both Kiri Brewer and Lizzie Armin on the show now. Hello, Steve. How are you?
Hi, I'm very good, Tom. It's so funny. I've known her as Dana Gillespie for probably 35 years.
She'd have told you off, Steve. Are you suggesting, Steve, that she's changed her name?
She's changed her name. I now want to hear her version of that song, because unlike you, the boy Latcham, I remember Hunky Dory when I was 14 years old, and it being one of the most inspiring, life-changing records that I ever experienced. And I was just listening to it on the phone, waiting to come on. And even after all these years, the wonders of great music, I could sing every bloody word, you know, and I have to say. But look, I'm a lucky man, because I put the accumulator on Lemmy, Stew Pot and Bowie. How great is that?
You're a dark man, Mr. Lillywhite. You're a dark man.
I got 150 to 1.
You're a dark man. Still, how much did you have on it?
I had a fiver. was well worth it.
Still, that's happy days. So, Steve, what was it about Hunky Dory that you love so much? And in what way did it influence you as a teenager?
Well, if you were listening to it right then, you would have heard little things that were left in, like the clapping at the end.
Mm.
And there are other songs in it which have what I would always call, and what I always try and do on my records, is like leave little clues. There were some, and Bowie's been doing that all his life.
Mm.
You know, he hasn't made it all neat and tidy. There's always little things, especially on those early records, and obviously late on, where, you know, when you have a furtive imagination, like we all do when we're young, there's so much little bits of chat and little things that were left in. And honestly, his the production style, the string arrangements, Rick Wakeman's piano playing, you know, all top notch.
And you
top notch.
You came to know him eventually, didn't you?
Yes. Well, I had a job in the early 2000s, about 10 years ago, I think. I had a job for Columbia Records where I was an A&R person. And he was signed to Columbia Records and didn't want to speak to anyone at the label. But I'd met him briefly back in the 80s, but no one really remembers the 80s. It was very far. It was, you know, it was very crazy. But he said, oh, well, there's one person in your company I'll talk to, and that's Steve Lillywhite. So I was sent off down to Soho in New York to go and basically try and convince him to make an album. Well, at that point he wasn't really interested, but we had a wonderful hour and a half, just me and him, until Iman came in and just talking about music and you know, just shooting the banter, really. He was you know, he really was. I mean, it's almost when you have such a crush on someone like I did on him, it's when you meet these people, they can never quite live up to your, you know, because he's just so normal.
Mm.
And all that, all the makeup and all that, that was a result of his shyness.
Wow.
You know, that was a result of him wanting to, he was just very shy.
Hmm.
But I was just thinking, you know, have you heard of, it was very lucky yesterday that no one suffered from Farrah Fawcett syndrome. Are you familiar with what that is, Tom?
No. What is it?
Farrah Fawcett syndrome. It's basically dying the same day as someone really famous.
But Steve, everybody's quitting their jobs, basically. And in fact, on the front page of the Daily Mail today, John Mann, the Labour MP, has suggested that it was a good day to bury bad news. There's a guy from the Environment Agency, he's resigned. And there's a guy, there's also the head of HMRC, this woman who's just become a dame despite having overseen an appalling reign. She's resigned too. It does seem that there have been, and also someone resigned from the Labour cabinet yesterday. So they're all resigning on the day that Barry died.
But I tell you why it's called Farrah Fawcett syndrome, because she died the same day as Michael Jackson.
Really?
But she died of anal cancer, which, to be honest, it's probably best that it was sort of buried, right?
Steve, have you had a bad night's sleep or something, Steve?
No, I just thought, this is FUBAR Radio. I couldn't say this.
You're absolutely right.
I couldn't say this to Mike Graham the other day.
No, this is very true. This is the only station in which you can say anal cancer. That is true.
Anal cancer. Those are two words that are perfectly... Look, shall I just tell you? You love the Daily Mail because you're a complete right-wing fascist, right? But so I was reading the Daily Mail about David Bowie, and literally this is what it says: but some Scottish nationalists celebrated his death because Bowie had called on Scotland to stay in the UK in 2014. One woman wrote on Facebook, "They say he got diagnosed 18 months ago. Maybe unionism gives you cancer." Isn't that the most...
To be honest, that is probably the only thing that Daily Mail has never said does give you cancer.
That's true. But you know, they went from saying, from one quote it on Facebook to saying Scottish nationalists celebrated his death.
Blimey, that's something of a stretch. So, did you stay in contact after you met him that one time for tea, or
no,
was that the last time?
But you know, I did know he was not well.
You did,
yeah. And in fact, before, and I had heard quite for the last 18 months, I'd heard he'd had quadruple bypass. But I don't know where I heard this from, because I've Googled Bowie quadruple bypass, and nowhere does it come up. So I don't know if I'm wrong, or I've been, you know, that there was some very, you know, there was some information that I'd heard from someone that has never been out.
Hmm.
But
so how did you know he was ill? How did you know he was ill, do you think? And what had you heard?
Well, because I met him and he was not that interested in doing anything, and he'd given up smoking.
Hmm.
But because he was a heavy smoker all the way up to 2003, when he had his stent put into his heart. So he does have a history of heart, but the only thing that was reported was that he had a stent put in. But no. I'd heard that there was more, but I don't know if that's true or not.
Mm.
But no, I mean, I don't think, well, there was, you know, you can talk about the Beatles, but that was only about 7 years of making a, you know, I can't think of anyone else who has more bang for their buck than David Bowie.
Do you think in a way that's because he regularly changed his character and his music, and sort of just, it's amazing how he knew what to do to stay so relevant.
Yeah, well, he surrounded himself with great people. I mean, you'll never get it when Francis Rossi dies, for instance.
Have you got him in your accumulator as well, Steve?
Oh, damn! That was the
first. It's fallen down.
That's a great thing now, because there are, you know, all my heroes are all pegging it from natural causes.
That will happen, Steve, when you're of an age.
It will happen, and then it'll be me, I won't be able to know.
No time soon.
Oh, who knows?
What do you think that Bowie would have thought of modern music, you know, artists like Kanye West?
Well, the thing about Bowie is that he always surrounded himself with the best people. You know, Mick Ronson was one of the greatest guitar players ever to come out of England, and he was taken away far too soon. And but you know, and then he predicted, he loved the German Germanic sort of Kraftwerk style. So you know, he would foresee styles. He actually he had a band called Tin Machine that really did foresee grunge. The thing is, he didn't quite get it. Nirvana came and did it better than him, actually. What's so funny about that? He did foresee, you know, he knew that style.
And what do you think that his legacy is going to be, finally?
Oh, it's as great as John Lennon. It's he wasn't. I think he hid behind his lyrics more than, you know, John Lennon was much more open with what he would say. But you know, but Bowie would say, you know, you make your own meaning out of my lyrics. So there was not really any, not much social conscience, you know, but social comment. I'm trying to think of social comment, but no, he was God. I mean, certainly you know, it's one of those things you'll remember. Well, certainly for someone of my years, young Tom Latcham, I remember where I was when I heard the news that David Bowie died. And it's a unique situation, because it's the first death that really utilized the social media right till the very end. You know, it's a weird world we're living in now, because I've got friends on Facebook who talk about their bloody cancer, and then all of a sudden they don't talk anymore, and you think, oh, they've died.
Yeah,
it's, you know, do you live it like some people do, or with Bowie, you know, he sort of lived it, but no one knew.
It's remarkable. You know, it's frankly remarkable.
Or like Lemmy, who just didn't bloody care he had cancer and didn't go to the doctors.
Did you know Lemmy?
Oh, I did know Lemmy, of course. But everyone knew Lemmy. That was the thing. Lemmy was fantastic and really intelligent guy and very well read and
lived hard to the end. You
know, yeah, well, exactly. Everyone else lost their nerve, didn't they? You know, Pete Townsend, hope I die before I get old. Well, you know, fuck that. He never did. And Lemmy, even Keith Richards is sort of slowing down a bit now.
He's still got a bit in him, Steve. Steve, listen, thanks for joining us, mate. It's been lovely to talk to you. Really, really fun and interesting and insightful. And I hope you don't pop your clogs anytime soon, because we love having you on the show.
Oh, good. Well, thank you so much, Tom.
Thanks, Steve. That's Steve Lillywhite there, legendary Grammy Award-winning producer. And we're going to play his favourite song, which is Let's Dance by David Bowie. It's 11:18 here on FUBAR Radio. It's FUBAR Radio. It's 11:22 here.
not much longer left to go. 40 minutes in this David Bowie tribute show. I'm here still with Kiri Bloor, my co-presenters, Kiri Bloor and Lizzie Armin. We're going to continue this one more interview on Bowie just briefly, and then we'll talk about their specialist subjects, a bit of sport after that at 11:30. Now, back in 2003, Alan Palmer interviewed Bowie about his relatively new relationship with his now widow, Iman, and how he kicked his drug habit. Soon after that, Bowie decided to step back from the limelight, making Alan one of the last British newspaper journalists to have interviewed the great man, and he joins us now on the phone. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Tom.
How are you, my friend?
Very good, very good. Yourself?
Yeah, I'm okay. Have you been left... I mean, you were quite a fan of his, weren't you? Have you been left sad, or are you sort of happy in the memory?
Absolutely broken, to be fair. My daughter rang me up in tears at about 7:15 when she heard the news. And that was the thing about Bowie, that it wasn't just the music, the impression it made to you, but it was the connections that it made with other people. Mm. It was my older brother, Owen, he introduced me to Bowie, and I always used to get into trouble nicking his records from him, and he used to get absolutely mad about it. And he then moved to Spain, and he played it to his children, and it was. And he died of motor neuron disease a few years ago, and that, Bowie was something that connected me to him, to my children, to my nieces, and that's what so many people are saying now, that it's not just the music, it's the way that the music has been there throughout their lives, and how it connects them to people.
You say that, but Steve Lillis, who comes on my show quite a lot, a boxing journalist, wrote that they played Under Pressure at his kids' school, and his kids said that they thought it was a cover of Jedward.
That's it. There's a very famous quote where he keeps on getting approached by people after Nirvana did The Man Who Sold the World, and then they'd hear his version of it. He says, "I've got people saying, oh, I love your cover of the Nirvana song," and he'd go, "Oh, just F off." He was not happy that, he was seen by a new generation as being a Nirvana covers band.
Well, I hope he wasn't watching X Factor. So tell us about the interview. How did it come about? I mean, you must have been giddy being such a fan.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the first time I met him was in 2008. It was the opening of the Pharmacy restaurant, which was this big showbiz multi-million pound restaurant owned by Damien Hirst and Blur. And there was... every star imaginable was at the restaurant for the launch party. And there was one man just hopping from table to table, taking photographs on a camera. And I realised it was Bowie. So I went over to him and I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Oh, this is a digital camera. And I put it on the internet where I've got a thing called a blog." And he spent about half an hour just explaining to me how, what this newfangled internet was, what digital camera was. And I was like, nobody had ever seen a digital camera at that point. And he just was... It was just the mark of the man that he was this wide-eyed space boy. He loved technology, he loved the future, and he was such a visionary in so many ways. And he was an early adopter of every kind of technology.
To be fair, you were at the Mirror at the time, weren't you, Alan? I mean, it took them ages to clock onto the internet.
Yes, well, that's it.
that's an industry joke there. I apologise for anybody who doesn't care about newspapers. So, I mean, when you did come to interview him in 2003, what was it like? Was anything off limits, or was he happy to just talk about everything?
No, everything was on limits. I mean, personally for me, it was kind of to do a good job as a journalist, to ask the probing questions, to get an interesting article. But inside, the interior dialogue while I sat with him was, "You're David Bowie, I love you." And I just wanted to hug him. It was just the most... a strange moment in my life. And you could see there were signs there that his public life was coming to an end. He was tired, his voice had been struggling on it. It was on the reality tour. I interviewed him in Paris in 2003, and you could see that he was struggling with the demands of touring. And on that tour, he was famously hit with a lollipop, which he was not happy about. And then he suffered a heart attack, and it was after that tour that he just completely decided to step back from public life and raise his daughter Lexi with his daughter Iman, because he felt that he wasn't there for Duncan, his first son, with Angie Bowie, and he would step away. And so interviewing him, he was tired. He was very happy and jokey, but you could tell he was weary, that this part of the process was something that he didn't really want to connect with, because he'd connected with his fans. He was one of the first to connect via the internet to his fans by having his own blog, creating his own personal space where he could actually he curated so much material on this pay-per-view website.
And he talked. Well, he talked a lot in the in your article about Imam, didn't he? Who's obviously the mother of his daughter Lexi, and how she'd come into his life at just the right time. How do you? I mean, they were obviously incredibly close. They had a, I mean, it was had a really interesting relationship where they sort of just separated their lives. They're both public figures, but they separated that, didn't they? They made sure that that didn't come in the way of their relationship.
That's right. They lived in Brooklyn, and it was Bowie was often seen just walking his daughter to school, and there was that was what he was happiest doing. And with Iman, it was just he was completely happy within that unit and secure within that unit. And there'd been there were so many rumours of his of ill health that for 10 years, all rumours kind of swirled around. We're hearing about you know how many heart attacks he's had and other illnesses that he's had, and. And that was a remarkable thing that 3 years ago, in 2013, on his birthday, just a few days ago, he suddenly, out of nowhere, he introduced the next day his comeback album. And just hearing the story behind that, his publicist got summoned on a, I think it was a Friday, to go to New York to meet with David. And he flew over to New York. Had a meeting with David and said, I've got an album, it's coming out on Monday, can you handle the press for it? And he was as taken aback as anyone that this had come completely out of the blue. He'd recorded it in secret, completely in private, and just sprung it as a surprise, a birthday surprise on the world.
And as a journalist, yourself, how, and particularly in a, you know, an age of internet, you know, and a plethora of outlets, how hard would that have been for someone like David Bowie to have done?
Well, it's just it was just impossible. You couldn't believe it. The amount of secrecy that would be involved in hiring studio space, everyone from an engineer to a T-boy to a runner who brings the sandwiches and the catering would have seen him, yet everybody kept the secret. Everybody kept it tight. There was the circle of people who knew. I was record label. There were only two people who knew, and that was the president and the vice president of the label. And but you had the musicians and the studios, and they just managed to keep it within that tight circle. And a lot of people, when people heard "Where Are We Now," the people thought this is it. This is Bowie saying goodbye. And people thought because he was reflecting on his past, the whole album was reflecting on his past. And yet, then this year, when he's dying from terminal cancer, he goes into a little neighborhood jazz joint near his home in New York and sees this incredible avant-garde jazz quartet. And they suddenly realise halfway through their set that David Bowie's in the audience, so they're a little bit taken aback. But they're more taken aback when a week and a half later they get a note saying, would you like to come into the studio and record with David Bowie?
Wow.
And so here he is dying of cancer, knowing that his time is limited. And he sees some music, which is how he always attracted him. He saw music that invigorated him, that infused him and made him work creatively, and he came up with Black Star, which is an incredible final album, and it's just a testament to the man that how he was always pushing the envelope, how he was always looking to the future, that even you know as he faced death he wanted to create yet more new music.
Cracking story. Alan, before I let you go, I think that if you ever do go on Mastermind, then Bowie is probably the one for you.
Yeah, I think that would be safe to say Huddersfield Town in 1933 or David Bowie, I think.
Huddersfield Town FC and David Bowie, not easy bedfellows, probably never mentioned in the same sentence together before, but we are a station of first at Fibre Radio. Alan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks,
mate.
Thanks very much, Tom.
All the best, mate. That was Alan Palmer, who was one of the last newspaper journalists to interview Bowie. So we're going to play Lady Grin and Soul. We're continuing this Bowie. We'll continue playing his music, but that's I think probably the last we'll mention him today, and we're going to talk a little bit about sport next, because we've got Kiri Blore and Lizzie Armand, who are sport experts, so we'll talk about that after this. This is Lady Grinning Soul by David Bowie. This is for Mark Solly in Essex. Hope you enjoy it.
Letcham on FIBA Radio.
Hello, it's 11:36, coming into towards the end of the show. We've got a little sports section now because my co-presenters for the day are experts in the field, and hopefully they're going to prove themselves thus. They are Lizzie Armand, who is a cricket and athletics...
pretty much everything bar football.
Bar football, who she says is full of idiots. And Kira Ebler, who presented until fairly recently... football show, on London Live.
Football and motor racing, my one.
You're right. We haven't got any motor racing to talk about, but we can talk about football. But right now, we'll talk. We'll let Lizzie tell us what we're going to talk about in terms of athletics, which isn't a particular forte of mine. Although, you know, obviously, the stench of cheating has always rattles my cage, and a bit of cricket.
I've got a solution to that as well.
Have so you? We'll hear that in shortly. So, Lizzie, what has tickled your or
well,
tickled your fancy over the weekend?
New Year, same old, same old. Yeah. We are stuck in the mire of corruption and doping and cheating. The UK athletics boss has sort of released a manifesto for clean athletics, which it has various merits to it. One of them, his proposals, is that we reset world records in athletics because some of the records are dominated by records that you would raise your eyebrows at, and which may never be beaten because they were allegedly... they were set by people who were under the influence, as it were. It's a problem. It's certainly a problem, particularly in women's athletics. There are the 100 and 200 metre records set by Florence Griffiths Joyner. No one can get within a quarter of a second of them. I mean, it's just, so what do you do? Are they just going to sit there and no one will ever be able to beat the record? Paula Radcliffe is against resetting the world record.
I agree with her, though.
But surely this is going to open them up to huge lawsuits
I don't think it's workable. I can see the logic behind
it's philosophy behind it,
but it's I think it's not right to reset. We kind of are where we are, aren't we, and we just have to kind of caveat where we are.
So Lizzie, if we're not going to reset the records, Seb Coe, head of the IAAF, seems to still have his head in the sand as regards to the cheating, and you know, initially obviously said this was a war on athletics. It now transpires that actually it's just the truth.
No, just people reporting the truth.
Exactly.
Yes.
So what would you do if you were Lord Coe, Seb Coe, to clean up athletics?
You've got to be absolutely adamant that you will leave no stone unturned, and that... athletics faces the same problem as we do in cricket about match fixing. I think there's some will there to get it done, but it requires a huge effort, and it requires
from everybody,
and it requires some pretty unpalatable stuff in terms of who you get rid of out of the sport. There's a very interesting article in the Mail on Sunday by the always excellent Oliver Holt, who I'm a big fan of, who has written about do the IAF even want to catch the cheats, and is Seb Coe. And I really am far from convinced that Seb Coe is the right man to be leading this fight.
Kiri, Ollie Holt in this claims that the IAAF, because it's been involved... there's a claim that DIAC that that they bribed someone who'd been taking drugs to keep it quiet. So I mean, this is actually allowing the cheating to happen, whereas FIFA was more just financial backhanders. So it's like two bald men arguing over comb, who's worse, frankly. But he does say that he thinks FIFA's worse. I mean, IAAF is worse. What do you think?
I mean, FIFA's a whole other world of issues, isn't it? I mean, the problem is, what I struggle to explain is that the world's corrupt. Every government, every position of power is corrupt in some way or other. So it seems slightly unfair to always take it out on the athletes, or, you know, as Paula Radcliffe said, there are athletes that are innocent, but there is no way of solving it, because even if you completely cleaned it up, eventually in 10 years' time, there will be one human being that wants to make more money or achieve more than another. That's human nature. Life will never be non-corrupt. It's just the one. So my solution is the doping Olympics. So everyone can do whatever they like.
I was going to suggest this. I want someone running the 100 metres in like a second.
Yeah, I know there's health issues there.
I want them jumping 100 metres in a second.
I know it's not the best solution, but the world is corrupt. We're not going to change the world. We either start again or do the doping Olympics?
What do you think of that, Lizzie? Is that the answer?
By all means, they can go off and do their doping somewhere out away from.
Why do we care so much whether people have been doped
or
not?
Story.
It all boils down to the fundamental reason why we all watch sport, isn't it? Because it's we want something that isn't life, that isn't our regular politicians and people dying and everybody getting ill, and you know we want something away from that. And if it becomes about something that's equally as murky as the world that we have to live in,
but it already is. It's never going to change, is it?
Also, you want to watch. The human endeavour. You want it's about the struggle and the human endeavour and all of that. And if it's about injecting,
and it's supposed to be a wonderful thing, isn't it?
Injecting some pharmaceuticals into you, then yeah, sod it. I'll have a go.
I still don't think we'd manage to do that well.
But see,
I'm a smoker. Right, never get to the other end.
Well, quite. That's kind of the in a way. I'm playing devil's advocate here. I'm not saying I necessarily believe it, but that's kind of the point, isn't it? It's like these are athletes. They're the top athletes.
They're not the top athletes
because they take drugs. They are the top athletes, but they are taking drugs.
Well, yeah.
And improving themselves. I mean,
but we, you know, we have decided that we would rather people did it without the aid of pharmaceuticals.
But the thing
and it's the same with cycling, isn't it? You know, it's as much about the fraud and the lying. Perhaps if people were, you know.
But does that matter? This is the thing. I still agree. Maybe with athletics, it's slightly different. But with the cycling, they've still achieved such amazing feats. And yes, they may have had help, but they wouldn't have been able to do it if they weren't some of the best in the business.
Yeah, but I think the problem we have had with cycling, it wasn't with Lance, it wasn't the taking the drugs per se that was the problem. It was the
level of
the intimidation, the bullying, the harassment.
Well, that's why it all came out so much, is because everyone's sick of it. Yeah,
and that is the problem here with the IAAF, that there is bullying, there's harassment, and
this is all just. It's human nature, so even if you cleaned everything up in 10 years' time...
But we fight against it in other walks of life, don't we? We say, that's not OK behaviour, so it's not OK behaviour in our...
Yeah, but I just don't think it will ever change, is what I'm... Eventually, it may change, there's going to be... And people will find ways around it. It's just...
Well, and also, of course, the definition of what drugs are OK or aren't changes on a regular basis. It's a very difficult to get to the bottom of
it. It's a murky area.
It is. I don't believe Sebco...
He's the right man.
He's the right man because he's, you know, he is what he is, and he's just a bit of a posh buffoon.
There we go. We've got to the bottom of that, of why Lordco's not the man. He's a posh buffoon. Cricket as well is another area of expertise. We've got the third test coming up for England and South Africa over there.
We have indeed. Good news for England, Dale Steyn is out of the third test. It's going to be a bit of
They're really rubbish, aren't they, South Africa? I mean, they're like...
technical insight, that is.
And without Steyn, I mean, you know, he's one of their very few stars.
Yes, they are in transition. They have been through
That's a polite way of saying they're rubbish.
They've been through a period of world dominance and they lost... You can't lose Jack Callis and Graham Smith and, you know, those great stars that they had and not struggle when you've lost those players of that calibre. They will be under the new captaincy of AB de Villiers, who will have a very different captaincy style and be tactically much more sound on the pitch than Amla was. Mm. And England have the luxury of having everyone fit and a pretty good seam attack to pick from. Pretty much everyone with the bat is in form. Some runs apart from Alistair Cook, but this is what Alistair Cook does. He has a lean period and then gets billions. All looking good going into the third test. Interestingly, Joss Butler has been released to go to IPL, and that is very interesting and is definitely the newer mindset under the management of Andrew Strauss that IPL is going to be an important part of England cricketers' development.
Right. And it's doing very well. Well, that's sort of that, the same format, 2020. It's doing very well in Australia, isn't it?
The Big Bash.
The 10th most watched
It's sport in the world. Phenomenal. It is absolutely phenomenal. And what it does is raise the questions again about whether we have a franchise system here in England. At the moment, we have the 18 first-class counties all playing in the NatWest T20 Blast. It's on a Friday night. It is what it is. It's pretty good. People slate it, and because it hasn't got huge crowds. I mean, you know, the oval's full.
It's not very pure either, is it?
Well, the oval's full and headingly, no, but T20 is what it is. And
it's rounders. It's rounders when they run along just a sort of straight line, right?
Here we go.
It's not for the bowlers, is it?
It's not much fun being a
or
bowler.
Or should I say
pitchers? But you know, they got 80,000 in the MCG watching a Big Bash domestic
still pretty
quick. And that's impressive. Yeah. It's really impressive. What people need to be a little bit careful of is that that doesn't translate to England. We are partisan. We are quite tribal about our county cricket. People are like their county cricket. They know which county they support, mm-hmm. not Nottinghamshire, Nottingham something made up. Mm-hmm. And we've got 140 years worth of county cricket history. Australia doesn't have 140 years worth of state cricket history. So there are lots of pluses to franchise cricket, and it will appeal to a newer market, theoretically. I just don't think that the size of the cricket watching public in England is the same as it is in India or Australia, because it isn't our it isn't
but then
our summer
sport. You can see how things can grow. Look at darts.
Darts and
love darts.
A very interesting case study for me is how NFL has grown in this country
and continuing to grow,
and is huge now, and how that is a lot down to simply how they've marketed it.
But that was a concise decision, and you know, even the Spurs ground is going to hold NFL games.
Yeah, as is Twickenham.
By the way, can I go back to darts just briefly?
Love darts. Yeah, come on.
This is the problem with what might happen if cricket goes down the Big Bash route. I went to darts the other day to the PDC.
No one, and
they're all standing up and waving their flags. And I was like, mate, I've paid 50 quid for this. I can't see. If someone asked me to take a photo of them during a 1:30 out shot,
yeah,
and
but
I was
that's
like,
not what the darts is about, is it? It's about
so you don't
drunk.
Love the darts. You don't love the darts. Whereas I love the darts, and I want. Well, you're now sneered upon for actually wanting
don't
to
be
watch
ridiculous.
The bloody thing.
Then you're
going
to have to watch
for.
The BDA, mate.
Exactly.
Yeah, but it's crap. It's really bad. They seem shocked when they get a 180. They have to dust off their. They have to dust off their 180.
The only reason anyone goes to the darts is to get wasted.
I have to say, I'm on my feminist high horse. It's 2016. Get rid of the war comp.
You're
girls.
Absolutely
get
right.
Rid
you're
of
absolutely
them.
Right.
There is. I don't.
You're
nobody.
Absolutely right. In fact, I tweeted
just
this.
Just get
rid
of them.
Would you get rid of grid girls as well?
Yes.
Oh.
Did you see this, Lizzie? I tweeted it. You know, because they were doing it. There was a video of Rod Studd or someone going, "Go on, girl, give us a twirl." And I was like, "Oh my goodness."
Because when I take. If I had a daughter, I have a son, but if I had a daughter and I took her to sport and she is watching the two genders, there's the dude who does the sport and there's the woman.
Even that's
so
not
my girl,
the case. It's 2016. It's not like the grid girls, they get paid loads of money. They do what they want. It's not.
They need grid boys as well in that case. My girlfriend, they don't have them on the darts. And no. My girlfriend went to the darts. This is a little final story. She was doled up to the nines because she was like a night out. She wanted to do that, but she hates the walk-on girls. But she was doled up to the nines, and she was walking through. She was walking through Ali Pali, and men after men after men were going, "Do you? Do you?
Yeah, but that's
do you? That's darts." And this
it's
is David,
not okay.
And this is
it's
David
not
Bowie.
Okay.
This is right. This is David Bowie. We'll be back to talk some football after this. Ballon d'Or. This is Football Radio. It's 11:49.
Now, 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 she's gonna push me in her side and I'm trying to, in her rock, oh, the 50. Winter Wall. Oh, the gun is so cold, it don't feel like no bed at all. Yeah, I lay down a while, look at my hotel wall. And he's down on the street, so I throw both his back.
Food by Radio 1152. I can exclusively reveal that my two co-hosts, Lizzie Armand and Kiri Bloor, were just at each other's necks here over feminism. But we won't go there. We'll just say that that was happening. I had to separate them.
Yeah,
but thankfully,
was,
they are now
holding fully, hands. Fully,
they're, on the, they're on the other side of the room. I've split them up. I'm in the middle. Anyhow, football. Ballon d'Or happened last night, Kiri. Who won and what happened?
Well, Messi won.
Again.
Fifth time.
Yeah.
Yeah, Neymar could have won it, I suppose. Ronaldo, I don't think, is going to win it again.
Because he's getting on.
Not that he's getting on, but also that I don't think he's at the same level that potentially he was. He's potentially only scoring in the smaller games. He's not really as, you know, I mean, I think it's time maybe for these three to move away and start seeing people like Hazard, Bale coming through and being the more prominent people.
Well, Hazard better up his game if he's going to do that. I mean,
I think
he's been
pony
this season.
Absolutely pony, but I think he will now. I mean, there's plenty of other players, and I think the Ballon d'Or was supposed to show that, wasn't it? It wasn't supposed to be the three men just all the time. But, you know, the right man won, didn't he?
And do you think Bale will win it one day? I mean, he's scoring for fun, isn't he? I mean, I wish, you know, I always say this, I wish he was English. I mean, there's no reason to wish he was English. He's Welsh. But, you know, it's like Ryan Giggs. Oh, God's sake, why are these fantastic players not English?
He should do, but then we've got to see how he's going to perform under Zinedine Zidane, haven't we? We've got it. That was obviously a big blow seeing Benitez go. So I think that
he scored a hat trick. Was that on his debut? Or was it? Yeah, he scored a hat trick on Zidane's debut. So he's not done too badly as so far.
I think we'll just have to see. But I think Bale will be one of the ones in the next couple of years that will win it. Yeah.
And Lizzie, Man United, very boring this season. Who else thinks that?
Their manager also thinks they're really boring.
And he is quite boring as well. I think the whole circle of boring just happens there.
Which, now, boring is fine. If they were 15 points clear at the top of the table, we'd all put up with boring.
The fact that they're not exactly doing
but boring
well.
And not winning is not okay.
It was very unlike Man United as well.
It is, and I think that that's the problem, is because when you have had a history and a recent history of not being, of being a team that people want to watch, a global brand that people actually want to watch, to go from that to this is like, oh, well, that's really galling and it's quite hard to take.
Do you think that people like, you know, someone like Paul Scholes, ex-players like Paul Scholes lining up to criticise Man United is helpful or
no,
not?
No, and I think that's what a lot of people have been saying when it comes to the World Cup, and everyone goes, oh, well, we won the World Cup back then, blah, 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 blah. Keep referring to the past is difficult. I was listening to a player talking, he was saying, you know, you walk in, you see the heritage, it's thrown down your face, and then it's always hard to live up to that. And I think it really isn't helpful to always have, well, we were once, because you're not now, so you need to get back there.
And to end with this, with a bit of symmetry, you can't exactly imagine Lionel Messi rocking up on the side of the Nou Camp with an umbrella going, oh, yeah, Barcelona aren't what they used to be, are they? You just can't imagine it. Paul Scholes needs to get a better hobby.
go and get a manager job. Get Neville's manager.
Anyway, that's it. That's all we've got time for today, unfortunately. But thank you, both of you, for coming in. Lizzie, where can people follow you on Twitter?
At Lakeside Lizzie.
Ooh. At what?
At Lakeside Lizzie.
Lakeside Lizzie.
The Lakeside. Oh, the Lakeside. Rather than the offside.
Hey.
Kiri, what about you?
It's not as exciting now. It's just at Kiri Bloor. I'll add some legs somewhere.
Kiri Bloor's legs. At Kiri Bloor's legs. Thanks to everyone who came on my show today. Record producer Steve Lillywhite, singer
Dana Like Spanner Gillespie.
You did it.
and journalist Ellen Palmer. Of course, you two, my co-hosts, Elizabeth Ellman and Kiri Bloor. Coming up at 4 p.m. is Doc Brown and Hugh Joseph. I hope you two will come back, by the way. It has been great to have you, and I'm sorry that there hasn't been more arguing, frankly, because that
we'll
was the
best. We'll hug and make up and then we'll come back.
That was the best bit. You can download my interviews as a podcast from iTunes and SoundCloud. Tom Latcham interviews, and I'm going to close the show with a brilliant David Bowie collaboration in tribute to the man. This suggested by Emma in Hampshire, and it's very fitting. It's Placebo and Bowie. Without you, I'm nothing. This is Fubar Radio. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next Tuesday.